which we have all had. Some of us remember them, some of us can't. Barbara Bishop, as it notes here in the program, has her PhD from UCLA in English, and she is at this point in time very interested in Jungian psychology, and so we'll be presenting a notion on dreams, prophecy, personal revelations, or nonsense with a certain amount of Jungian slant. We'll have a response from Jess Grosbeck, who is a psychiatrist and a Jungian analyst. He's a training analyst for two psychoanalytic institutes, as well as an associate professor of psychology, psychiatry, up at UC Davis, as well as at University of Utah. And he's very interested in genealogy, as well as president of the Grosbeck Genealogy Society. So we'll now start with Barbara.
In 1 Nephi 8:2, Lehi says, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream," or in other words, "I have seen a vision." Note that Lehi does not distinguish between a dream and a vision here. His interpretation, in fact, acts as a prophecy regarding his family and modern readers. In numerous other religious traditions, such as Sufi, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and others, dreams provide evidence of God's hand in man's world. In Joel 2:28, for example, the prophet said, "And it shall come to pass afterward," and he's prophesying about the modern day, "that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions." Jungian psychologist Marion Woodman says, "I believe that God is the dream maker. The dream is our banquet spread every night, and we can choose to eat or we can choose not to." In God's Forgotten Language, John Sanford claims that our refusal to pay attention to dreams stems from a, quote, "tyranny of rationality," unquote, that has gripped the modern world. He writes that Christians are afraid today of that very soul from which our heritage springs. We want creeds, not religious experiences, and dogma, not inspiration. The symbolism of dreams, like the symbolism of religious mythology, has largely been lost to the modern world. Mythology has become petrified dogma, and so rather than drinking from the living waters of a rich symbolic flow which reminds us hourly, daily, and weekly of the transcendent, creative, and mystical elements in our lives, we focus on external reality, growing paralyzed, neurotic, and depressed. In addition, our psyches and religious organizations reflect a one-sidedness that ignores the feminine divine. Joseph Campbell notes that although mythological symbols may either be lost to us collectively or may not speak to us personally, we can still recover our own personal mythology by attending to our dreams. Dreams can provide self-knowledge, warning, wisdom, and experiences with the divine. Understanding dreams can propel us forward on a spiritual and creative journey. Today, I want to share with you just a little of the wealth of information which dreams can provide and discuss in more detail a certain type of dream in our patriarchal culture, some problems in interpretation, and possible solutions. I want to start by telling you some dreams of personal revelation that people have just sort of spontaneously told me about this year. A friend recalls that when she was a young married woman and 7 months pregnant, she and her husband had planned to move from Idaho to Provo so he could finish his education at BYU. Their housing arrangements fell through at the very last moment, and my friend went down to Provo just a few days before class started to find another apartment. After looking for an entire day, she could find nothing suitable and was desperate. You can't hear me? Okay, so she could find nothing suitable. She was desperate. That evening, she prayed fervently for some direction. When she awoke the next morning, she recalled a single word from a dream, Bushnell. It appeared without context, and she had no associations to that word. She decided to search the yellow pages for some realtors with rentals and suddenly noticed the name Bushnell Real Estate. Without bothering to check the other real estate companies, she went to Orem, and to this company, and the man in the office cautioned her about this home, but he took her to the perfect home for their family that year. A friend in my ward described to me a series of precognitive, or what I would consider prophetic, dreams. Quote, in 1984, I dreamed of a beautiful house in the clouds, and a big black man was coming down from there. Now, she's a Mexican woman, and at the time she had these dreams, she was living in Mexico. His eyes were on me like he was coming to get me. I knew he was coming to get me, and I was afraid. I had another boyfriend at the time, and in the dream, we were swimming together. I said to my boyfriend, let's go, because that man you see is coming to get me. I pulled my boyfriend out of the pool, but he wouldn't run. I tried to run, but this black man kept running towards me. A year later, Rosa dreamed again of this unknown black man. This time, they were holding hands together. In the dream, she looked at him and said, what am I doing here holding hands with this black man? Then she said to him, I was afraid of you. In the dream, they were walking together in the park, and the man was telling her all about his plans for the future. In 1986, Rosa came to the United States, saw and recognized instantly the man she had dreamed about. She watched him from a distance because, and asked people about him because she was still afraid. And she told me later that she had never thought that she would ever marry a black man. By this time, she knew that his name was Michael Rice. In 1987, she had the following dream. Michael and I were walking together in the Los Angeles temple, holding hands, dressed in wedding attire. Heavenly Mother was waiting for us. She was so loving, everyone was waiting for us. Heavenly Father was there and introduced us to the congregation. We were going to be crowned. We were so surprised, and suddenly I saw nothing. Everything was over, there was a blank, and then everything was white. Heavenly Mother said, come this way, everything is all right. She guided us to an empty room. I saw an altar and a table of white, white rock in the middle of the room. I was naked, but this was not important to her. I was concerned and embarrassed, but she was totally accepting. She said, everything is going to be fine. Inside is your husband. This man is going to be your husband for time and all eternity. Let's see. Then I woke up, and I knew that I was going to marry Michael. And in fact, she's married to him, and they have three children. Yes, you say, of course God was in charge of that dream. But is God the director of dreams of excrement? Nightmares, our flying dreams, as well as our falling dreams, and our mystical, as well as our sex dreams? From my own experience with dreams, I have concluded that the unconscious is the realm where the human and the divine commingle. For although the dream symbols and personalities are mine, I often gain a wisdom and deeper understanding of people and situations that could not have come from me alone. We often get lost in the metaphors. In a dream, symbolic images are designed to, quote, take us from the concretized level through the transformer to the spiritual level. And sometimes people get lost at the metaphor. That is, they take it literally a lot of times. Symbols represent something else. Certain dreams have a visionary quality to them that propel me forward, even when I do not consciously recognize and remember all of the important symbols of the dream. Paul writes that we see through a glass darkly. Dreams, I believe, occasionally offer us a face-to-face experience. Nowhere is this more evident than in dreams in which Jesus appears. Laura Hansen recalls a dream she had as an 11-year-old. In the dream, she was sitting with her Sunday school class, and Jesus came and sat down next to her. He was clothed in white robes, and he put his arm around her. She felt peace, tranquility, reassurance, and happiness. The day after she had the dream, she reported the dream twice, once to her mother and later to her family at the dinner table. Laura told them that Jesus had said she would be the first woman to receive the priesthood. At the time, her mother had never talked to her about women and priesthood, nor had anyone else. Later, when she recalled the dream, she remembered it slightly differently, which I think is interesting. She recalled that Jesus told her, "We are special." Laura's dream and her later response to it suggest the presence of what Jung called the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious contains not just the individual's personal symbols, but the symbols, beliefs, and thinking patterns of families, religions, and cultures. This dream suggests that Laura was connecting up with the unconscious of her mother. Though Nadine Hansen had been silent, much was nevertheless communicated. This does not deny that it was Laura's dream or that it was possible revelation. I hope it was revelation. Like many dreams we ponder long afterwards, this one had a profound effect on Laura, even though she forgot the dream. Laura reported that the dream helped her to feel better about staying in the church because she has felt that it will all work out in the long run and has believed that men would not always be the only ones in power. A woman in my ward dreamed about Jesus when she was investigating the church but had not yet joined. She was having a difficult time making a decision, and she had prayed about it, but she had a real hard time with certain parts of the religion. One night, she had the following dream. I was in a park with some friends. Someone was flying a kite. In the kite, I see Jesus Christ's face. I point out to someone and say, "Look at the kite! Look at the kite!" Then I turn to my left and Jesus is sitting next to me. I say, "It's you!" I have never felt so loved in my life. I had a great sense of peace. I asked him, "Is this the true church?" Then I said, "Wait! Let me give you a hug and a kiss." He gets up and is hugging me. Just behind him, or maybe above, I start seeing this intense, bright, bright light. He says, "Don't look at the light." I say, "Why?" He says, "If you look at the light, you will die." I close my eyes and keep hugging him, but it was very hard not to look at the light. I sort of open my eyes slightly and peek, and as I glance, I feel like I'm going to faint. I ask Jesus, "What's wrong with me? What's happening?" He says, "You're dying." He told me with a sharp tone in his voice, "I told you not to look at the light. Why did you look at the light?" He was disappointed. Then I woke up. Damaris told me that she learned a lot about herself from this dream. She said, "I learned that I am not patient. I didn't listen. When he was going to give me the answer, I interrupted him. I didn't let him speak. When he commanded me not to look, I was not obedient." Yet she, like Laura Hansen, also reported feeling great peace and love from Jesus Christ's presence. So far, I've reported some very positive dreams. If we had dreams like those every night, probably all of us would listen every night. But dreams tell the truth about our psyches, and often the reason we don't listen to dreams is because we don't want to hear what the dreams have to say. Dreams can upset the status quo. They move energy in directions that threaten to produce chaos. We may not want to know things about us that force us to redefine ourselves. Many dream images, especially dark symbols, frighten and confuse us, and we turn away from dreams altogether in bewilderment. However, sometimes telling a dream out loud to someone can help us to understand what it's about and to kind of clarify it so it turns out to be a more positive dream than we had thought. Perhaps the most misunderstood type of dream of all is the dream with sex. Often they are not about sex at all. In December, my brother told me about a dream in which he was having sex with a 16-year-old in his ward. The dream naturally upset him. In fact, he didn't really want to tell me the dream, but he wanted to know what I thought it could mean. He asked me if I thought that it meant he was unconsciously wanting to have sex with a 16-year-old in his ward. I suspected that the Freudian interpretation that it was wish fulfillment or unconscious wishes was not quite right. So I said, "What are your associations to this girl? When you think of her, what are your first thoughts?" He said, "She's in the choir. She sits a few rows down from me. I don't know anything else about her." Then I asked him about singing in the choir. My brother loves to sing, but as a teenager and young adult, he wouldn't join the ward choir because he thought it wasn't manly. Like many men and women in our culture, he aligned himself with a narrow definition of masculinity. Also, the men in my family are workaholics. They have a difficult time relaxing, taking vacations, or doing anything that is not related to their professions. So joining the choir for my brother represented a reconnection with feeling or subjective values and those we sometimes associate with the feminine. Singing in a choir has no economic value, only aesthetic, emotional, and spiritual. Choosing to join the choir for him represented a union with a part of himself he had previously denied, which was represented in the dream by sexual union with another member of the choir. The dream had a positive feeling when considered symbolically. When not considered symbolically, it was very disturbing to him. When we fail to take the symbolic nature of dreams into consideration, we can create a lot of trouble in our waking lives, and it might have been better to have left the dream alone entirely. Dream images and figures can often offer us information about ourselves, but the danger lies in identifying with these symbols and shadow figures until we become unconscious to the point that we have become obsessed or possessed by them, rather. Recently, I heard about a young woman who, in the office of her therapist, revealed a striking dream she had in which she and her father were having sex. The therapist concluded that the dream contained significant information, but her accompanying reaction to assume automatically that the young woman should be removed from an unsafe home needs further examination. The father, in this case, expressly denies that he has ever raped his daughter or sexually abused her in any way. This, of course, and I know this does not prove his innocence. I hesitate to broach the topic of incest at all because I am aware of the great pain it inflicts on so many people. My intention is not to be unsupportive of sex abuse victims, but only to talk about dreams with incest in them. In contemporary society, writes Marion Woodman, incest dreams are coming increasingly into focus. In interpreting dreams of incest, however, we need to be mindful of their possible symbolic nature. To interpret a dream of incest concretely, when it is in fact part of a psychic process controlled by the unconscious, can cause needless suffering outwardly and confound the process inwardly. Incestuous imagery can, but not always, symbolize our richest source of creativity. Carl Jung writes about incest extensively throughout his collected works. He notes that although the sexual union of close blood relatives is everywhere taboo, it is yet the prerogative of kings, and he cites the incestuous marriages of pharaohs as examples. In mythology, then, incest becomes the holy marriage and symbolizes the union with one's own being. It means individuation or becoming a self. As a metaphor, incest expresses the union of elements that are akin or of the same nature. In dreams, then, incest as a symbol can represent the instinct for wholeness. Thus, it would not be uncommon for dreams of incest to appear in a person healing from some childhood trauma. A friend of mine, a victim of child sexual abuse by her grandfather, recently dreamed of incest between herself and her brother. Upon waking, she felt especially close to her brother, as if they had been connected spiritually. Her dream represented for her not misuse of power and abuse, but union and intimacy. She recognized the dream content as symbolic of her acceptance of her sexuality and the movement towards healing. In support of this notion, it is perhaps useful to report a saying of the Senoi, "Never turn down love in a dream." Consideration of how the sex feels in the dream, loving or exploitative, can offer us clues about interpretation. It is important to note, however, that sometimes incest in dreams is not symbolic of transformation at all, but instead points to some sexual abuse which occurred or is occurring in waking reality. In On the Way to the Wedding, Linda Leonard offers the example of a client who dreamed repeatedly of her father sexually abusing her. The dreams confused her because she had no memory of that ever happening, and she didn't understand where the images were coming from or what they might symbolize. In fact, the dreams could not be interpreted metaphorically. At home for a funeral, this client happened to talk with her father, who suddenly told her that because of some dreams he had had recently, he recalled how much he had enjoyed, quote, stroking her pussy, unquote, when she was a baby after giving her a bath. The dreams had been sending her a message that her father confirmed, though, of course, he obviously did not perceive himself as a child molester. Sometimes incestual images in dreams, particularly in children, may point to unconscious desires and energies being played out between parents and children. A girl whose parents were estranged from one another but still pretending union in front of their child brought an incest dream to Carl Jung. Now, this is the child who brings the dream to him. He writes, "What this child seemed to feel most was the unconscious of her father. If a man has no real sexual relations with his wife, then obviously he seeks another outlet. And if he is not conscious of what he is seeking, or if he represses fantasies of that kind, his interest will regress and invariably fasten on his daughter, if there is one. This is what might be called unconscious incest." In this case, you could say that no actual incest had taken place, but the child felt the unconscious incest and it became manifest in her dream. The father-daughter relationship in our patriarchal culture assumes many different outward manifestations of unconscious incest. The contortions the soul undergoes in resisting power feel like, and so are, forms of emotional rape. The common dream of being raped by a patriarch, either one's own father or one of the numerous collective fathers, has numerous implications for the individual in our society. Because we live in a violent culture that has raped the earth and discounted and ignored feeling values for so many centuries, the collective unconscious and the individual unconscious from which our dreams originate are filled to the brim with Nazi officers, rapists, assassins, and psychotics. Dreams of violence reveal how out of balance our society is. the concept of masculinity has become aligned solely with patriarchy and power, and femininity has been sentimentalized and reduced to its current inert, powerless form. A few years ago, I had a series of dreams in which I was raped, pursued, and chased into corners. I dreamed I was married to a madman. I awoke each morning exhausted, and if you've ever had a dream like that, you understand how tiring it is. I had to own this extensive list of nefarious characters without identifying with them. They were part of my psyche. Then the energy changed, and I dreamed of killing these potential rapists. I brandished guns and knives. In one dream, I picked up a would-be assailant, dumped him on his head, and beat him to death. Those are also horrifying dreams. Such dreams initially surprised and horrified me. Did I have such violent instincts? I came to recognize that I was evolving from a victim into a person who felt capable of defending myself. At the same time, I dreamed of tall, impersonal, chilly, empty buildings. I had been a feminist for many years, and I was surprised to find these cold, bureaucratic, lonely symbols of power in my dreams. Then, I dreamed of leaving them, driving away on a freeway. One night, I dreamed that a Nazi officer died. He left two young sons, whom I comforted and loved. I awoke with the knowledge that I had the capacity to nurture, love, and guide these orphans in my psyche abandoned by patriarchy. When the tyrannical figures appeared less often in my dreams, I felt increasingly empowered to effect positive changes in my own life. Through an extensive and continuing process that has involved dialoguing with and changing my unconscious patterns, the patriarchy in my psyche is gradually collapsing. What emerges from that death is a growing awareness of how spirit operates in matter. Whereas patriarchal discourse often positions spirit and matter as opposite terms and asserts the ascendancy of spirit over matter, in Eastern philosophy the two are not separate. Body and spirit together make up the soul. If we return now to the example of the young woman in therapy who dreamed that she and her father had sex together, we have numerous possibilities for what her dream might be conveying. Holy marriage, wholeness, sexual abuse, or unconscious incest. But you will note that I am not offering a definitive interpretation. There are risks involved whenever we approach the unconscious. A dream offers information or a revelation, but has the potential to be badly misinterpreted to hurt family members and the dreamer herself or himself. Dreams can prove frightening and dangerous, especially if we fail to understand our own shadow figures. Dreams often pose more questions than answers. Their meanings may become apparent only many months or years later. Dream interpretation thus requires meditation, prayer, and a lot of patience. So, you might ask, why bother with dreams at all? I believe that the kingdom of God is within us. But as a society, we are not able to see it because there is so much junk piled all around it. What remains unconscious continues to affect us, our families, our religion, and our culture. My internal unconscious tyrants affected my marriage and my children without my ever knowing it. I remained a patriarch long after I thought of myself as an enlightened feminist. When I had unconscious psychotic energy internally, I transmitted that cold, hard energy out into the world. By listening to my dreams, I can dialogue with and sufficiently neutralize violent energy when it appears instead of conveying it to those around me. My dreams, thankfully, are no longer only about power conflicts. They suggest that the energy has changed in a more loving direction. Much more transformative work needs to be undertaken, however, in everyone. Our society seems to be growing more violent, not less. The dangers from unconsciousness are very real and are evident in every newspaper, every day, in every city, and in many families. In addition, our religion remains rigidly patriarchal and controlling because those types of figures remain unconscious in the individual psyches of church members and thus in our collective unconscious. But I have evidence that the energy is changing in a positive direction. I want to tell you these last two dreams, and I consider them prophetic. I've heard other people say that they're not, but I consider them prophetic. One is a dream from 1979, and another is a dream from 1993. They demonstrate clearly Marion Woodman's claim that dreams move ahead of where the culture is. Now, when I tell you this next dream, I want to use the vernacular. I want to swear, okay? Dreams tell the truth, and the language we use has connotations that point to how the dream should be interpreted, and I hope no one will be offended. This dreamer learned in the late 70s that the church was lobbying against the ERA officially and lying about its official role. It was her first awareness of lying for the Lord, and it was a very painful time in her life that prompted the following dream. In the dream, I woke up and there was clear slime all over the floor. At first, it looked like just a little bit. It didn't look bad or smell bad, but I knew it was shit. I knew it was filthy. When I first saw it, I was embarrassed because I thought I had caused it. I quickly got a sponge and started trying to clean it up. But as I began cleaning, I saw that there was not just a little bit. It was all over the room. There was far too much of it for me to have produced. I also realized that this little sponge in my hand was no match for what by now I could see was an enormous problem. My husband got up and went into the bathroom to shave and shower. He seemed completely oblivious to the effluent that by this time was all over the bedroom and down the hall. Then a couple of my kids got up and began walking around in it and putting their hands in it. I tried to shoo them away, but I kept seeing more and more of it everywhere. I became more and more anxious and desperate about it, both because I was fighting a losing battle against the shit and because I couldn't keep the kids out of it. Meanwhile, my husband had gotten out of the shower and was standing in front of the mirror shaving and combing his hair. He couldn't see that there was any problem. I shouted at him, "Help me! Can't you help me keep the kids out of this mess?" I believe this dream prophesies many of the problems and issues that have become apparent in our church during the 1980s and 1990s. Like the dreamer's husband, many church members have been unable to see the mess. But as in the dream, the problems have only increased, not disappeared. We can see issues of sexual and ecclesiastical abuse, power struggles between scholars and church leaders, and many, many other incidents in this context. Indeed, upon waking, the dreamer immediately associated the dream with what was happening in the church. She noticed that, like many Mormon women, her first reaction to the excrement was to assume that it was her problem alone. The dream indicates that it is not her problem alone, nor is she capable of cleaning it up by herself. The filth in this 1979 dream, some church members are still trying not to see. Some are trying, with limited success, to clean up, and still others are stepping into it and sinking beneath the filth. Messes that we cannot see cannot be cleaned up. This 1979 dream prophesies the present moment. Keeping in mind Marion Woodman's suggestion that dreams move ahead of the culture, I'd like to read to you this dream that Kim McCall had in the fall of 1993. His dream, in contrast to the dream I just read, offers us a collective vision of the future that I find very encouraging and positive, and I hope it's prophetic. I'm attending General Conference. The first two or three talks are really quite nice, and I was sort of humbled by feeling that they were better than I had expected. Then somebody started using code words that meant he was going to start delivering the harsh, restrictive, condemnatory message we had been led to expect. I told a friend, "Uh-oh, here it comes." As the speaker began to escalate his rhetoric, suddenly tens, hundreds, then thousands of people started raising their hands. Each held a white rose. They'd raise and lower them in a sort of chaotic union. Some of us were less well prepared and raised our unadorned hands. It was a silent and very powerful witness that we did not agree with the words of this leader. But it was done with a fair amount of love and respect. After a short time, the speaker found it impossible to continue. It seemed to me that maybe three-fourths of the assembled saints were raising their hands, not in anger, but in a resolute refusal to be demeaned and dismissed. Someone on the stand decided to zero in on one 30-year-old sister and try to force her to account for the actions of this group. She calmly explained that this was not some clandestine organization, but that we all had some minimal access to electronic mail, and someone had suggested doing this, and it looked like lots of people thought it was a good idea, simply, innocently. By now, conference was thoroughly disrupted. The leadership was a bit angry, but mostly kind of dazed. Things sort of broke up into lots of smaller discussions. Some large woman, possibly Sister Monson or Sister Hinckley, came down and started to ask me, and someone next to me, in a fairly accusing way, what we thought we were doing and whether we didn't realize what we were going to lose by leaving the church. I took her hand and said something like, "Don't you see? We're not leaving the church. We love it. We want to make our contributions, and we want the church to have all the light, truth, and strength it can have. We want to be part of building it with all the talents the Lord has given us. We love the church, and we're definitely not leaving unless we're thrown out." She was sort of shocked and taken aback. She felt my sincerity, and as a woman, she responded as a mother who would never want to see one of her children cast out of the family. She still didn't know quite what to make of all this sudden insistence on the rights of lesser members, but her reproach was gone, and she wanted to listen. Some big bodyguard type of man saw what was happening and quickly, this is a very long dream, and quickly came over to hustle her away before she could be further perverted by my dangerous influence. He just used his size and strength to cut me off from her, so I started to talk with him. At first he just refused to communicate, but fairly soon he felt, though he wouldn't admit it, the truth and power of what I was saying and my right to say it. Sure wish I could remember what I said. As I kept talking, he started growing smaller and less intimidating until he was even smaller and weaker than I. By now, the tabernacle had more or less cleared out. President Benson was still there in fine health and in command of his faculties. One zealot had discovered something like President Benson's personal check register, or perhaps some check register of the church. He was busy turning the hearts of the leaders against these rebels because one of them had made a couple of extra entries in the checkbook, withdrawing money to pay for a couple of white roses. At first, I was shocked and dismayed, but I pled with the leaders not to judge a whole group because of the stupid or wrong actions of a single misled member. But they weren't buying it. But then I took a closer look at the checkbook. If you'll look a little more closely, you'll see that those entries are in the deposit column. Whoever did this, in secret no less, loves the church and wants to contribute. The symbolism of a person making a genuine contribution but having it seen by others as a debit occurred to me only after I woke up. President Benson continued to believe that these people were enemies of the church, so I talked to him personally. "Don't you see what you're doing? Don't create enemies where they don't exist. We're not leaving the church. We love the church. We believe the gospel, and we love to serve in the church." He didn't know quite what to do with all this, and he started retreating. I felt like he didn't know where he fit in a church where he was supposed to be in charge, but he was being told and experiencing that he had as much to learn from members as the other way around. What was he supposed to do with his rigidity and power in a new world where these were no longer valued or even legitimate? Then I woke up feeling reassured that my love for the church is real. Dream interpretation is not a scientific endeavor. It requires a trust in the intuitive and a receptivity to the spirit. It sometimes constrains us to wait for information. But Carl Jung maintains that images of the unconscious place a great responsibility upon a person. This ethical obligation compels me to examine myself, to become conscious, and encourage consciousness in those around me.
Well, it's an honor to be asked to comment on this very fine paper of Barbara's. And I won't take long, but just make a few salient comments. There are so many areas one could go into here that time wouldn't permit that. First, a general critique of the paper. Unfortunately, I think the paper opens up so many new terms for many people that it might be difficult to follow, terms that there was not time to really explore. Terms like Jung's concept of the collective unconscious, wholeness, individuation, and then some of these highly interesting and controversial areas around sexual abuse, dreams of sexual abuse, and so forth. I think in some of the final dream presentations, there's what we would have to call a species of wild analysis. Since the days of Freud, it was often said that once one gets into this rich symbolism of the unconscious, you can begin to go a lot of places. And wild analysis is a term which means an imprecise kind of application of concepts about the unconscious to a lot of data. And I would have to say that there's certainly a lot of that in this paper. However, there certainly is really, I think, a very important, valuable thrust, and that is best typified by Barbara's statement that dreams help us mingle the human and the divine, and I think that's true. Certainly not every dream is from God, but certainly many are, and I think that's the exciting thing about dream work. I years ago predicted, perhaps out of my own experience and maybe more personally than collectively, that the day would come that Mormonism would be swept and possessed by Jung's and Jung's ideas, because it would be an answer to many people's struggles around their religious faith. And I think this is a good example here today. I do think that time will really see a lot more of Jung's influence amongst Mormons, because his work is so congenial to the religious spirit and to what happens. I know my own, I owe a great debt of gratitude to Jung and the work that I was able to do in my early years around his ideas, because it certainly helped save my faith many times in the intellectual crises I faced in early years in my own training as a psychiatrist and later as an analyst. Let me just quote something now to make a couple of comments about more specific elements of the dreams to illustrate the function of dreams and how they can be valuable for us, certainly as Latter-day Saints. Alma says in the 29th chapter of Alma that the Lord speaks unto every person and every culture, every nation, in their own language and in their own tongue, that which he would see that they should have. Now, if we take that statement specifically to us, I think really that happens, and it happens specifically, I think, in dreams. I think we talk about unconscious processes, and I think that what we mean mostly by that is the symbol-making aspect of our minds that speaks in images and affect at night. I won't go into the background of what dreams are, but we know they are a natural phenomenon occurring to everyone. And if we didn't dream, we would be very shortly psychotic or crazy before we knew it. And so I think that we need to remember that dreams really are a great companion. For example, how would you like to have an advisor walking around with you 24 hours a day, who knows more about you and about your situation or any given problem you're struggling with than anyone else in the universe? Number two, how would you like to have that advisor available to you to give you that timely direction that you would most like to have in those moments when you're just desperate to know which way your life should go? Well, I would submit to you that the dream maker, as we often call it, is there if we can translate this, the message that come. I think too often we do not listen. For example, just listen to real history. There were two great heads of state. Both of them had what we call big dreams. One of them listened to the dream and saved his whole nation and his life and the destiny of his whole civilization. Another one did not listen and lost his own life. Who were they? Well, you may recall King Pharaoh, or the Pharaoh in Egypt, who had the dream of the seven, the lean cows and the seven fat cows. And you recall that he was wise enough to call in that dream interpreter, Joseph, who interpreted that dream about the future of what was going to happen in Egypt. And of course, the whole history of civilization changed because of that dream, and what was done about it, and because he listened to the dream. You also may recall, if not, that Abraham Lincoln, 1 week before he was killed, had a dream in which he woke up with mourning and crying in the White House. He asked one of the people there what was going on, and they said, "The president has been assassinated." And he looked out, and here was the coffin of the president. It was his own funeral. And he woke up and told his wife about it, and she, of course, was very terrified of that, as she was terrified of many things, as was he. And he said, "Well, it's just a dream. We can forget about it." And unfortunately, within a week, we know what happened. And so I think those are rather sobering, very great experiences of the dangers of not listening to dreams. What are dreams? I think Jung gave a great answer when he said, "Dreams are spontaneous images that self-portray in symbolic form the actual situation in our inner lives or in our unconscious life." In other words, if we could really understand them as these natural products of our lives, they really tell us at the moment what is most relevant, what is really happening to our whole psychological situation. Now, Jung went on to describe several different aspects of this, and I won't take a lot of time to define them, but only to give you kind of a rough idea. Jung talked about the fact that in our particular conscious attitude that we have about any given problem, any given conflict or whatever we're struggling with, a dream can, in a compensatory way, add to that which we do not understand or do not have to answer the questions we're looking for. So if, for example, you approach your dreams each day by saying, now, here's a dream I had last night. What is it trying to tell me that I do not know consciously? In other words, you may have rationally thought out all the details of a particular situation you're working on. And you've exhausted all the possibilities. Well, if you make that assumption that the dream is now going to add something that you couldn't know or couldn't possibly know without the dream, you have sort of a rough working formula or way of taking the dream and adding it to then what you don't know. I think there are several good examples that Barbara quotes in her paper on that score. For example, the dream of the woman who looked for the real estate agency is probably a good example. It may well have been that this was an example of cryptomasia in which she had learned unconsciously at some point in time about real estate, and this knowledge came to her rescue when she consciously was at her wit's end. And that might be a good example of Jung's idea of compensation. Dreams also, for example, open the door to perceive from other key people things that only they have that we need to know at the time. For example, the young girl who she quotes about Jesus visiting her and the whole issue of her being special, woman in the priesthood and so forth, and that this related something to her mother. It may well have been, you see, that this girl was unconsciously picking up something from her mother's inner world that the mother had not discussed consciously that this girl now needed. And so in a way, you see, our dreams then can actually bring messages from other people that we selectively need at that moment to help us. And so, for example, when you dream of anybody else, you should scrutinize that person and say, now, what is it that person knows that they could tell me? For example, my good friend Terry O'Brien in the background, whom I've known for many, many years, I've had dozens of dreams of him throughout my life. And Terry knows a lot about a lot of things that I don't know about myself. That's one of the continuing wonderful things about our relationship. The same with Bill Newman, another friend of mine whom I've known for 50 years. I've had many dreams of him. And so when they appear in my dreams, I know that there's something about them that they need to communicate to me that I need to know at the moment. Now, finally, let me go to another function of a dream here that's very, very meaningful, and that was the one of the woman who dreamt of Jesus when she was investigating the church. But she couldn't make a decision about that. It seems as though that was the background of her conscious situation. She was obviously impressed and deeply moved by the Mormon missionaries and their message. But you recall she had this dream of Jesus, and Jesus came to her. And notice these parts of the dream. She never felt so loved in her life. And then she asked him the question in the dream, is this the true church? Then I say, wait, let me give you a hug and a kiss. And so there's this interchange. And then Jesus goes through this part of the dream which says, don't look at the light. And he tells you, if you look at the light, you'll die. But it's hard not to look at the light. And finally, she feels like she's going to faint. She asks what's happening, and she's told that she's dying. And then she's told, I told you not to look at the light. Why did you look at the light? He was disappointed when I woke up. Well, I think this dream, if we look at it in its depth, it's telling us the problems this individual was having with her conscious situation. Why was she having trouble making a decision about joining the church? You know, she wanted to narrow it down to the simple question, is this the true church? Is this the church I should join or not? Well, you see, the dream now, in a compensatory way, or as Jung would describe it, in a prospective way, is trying to change now her whole conscious attitude. By perspective, Jung meant that rather than just be compensatory to the conscious situation, dreams often will try to make a wholesale rearrangement of your conscious thinking. It's trying to say, you're not even asking the right questions. You need to reframe the issue in a larger picture. Number one, the dream is saying here, look, you're getting the light. You're getting the love. No wonder you're attracted to this message. No wonder it's appealing to you. You've got to get beyond just the question of that you're asking on a limited basis. But there's another problem, and here is what you're having problems with. You are so fascinated by it. You are so identified with looking at the light. What does that mean? Well, I don't know, but let me just speculate. Does it mean that she's so attracted to this idea of virtue and goodness and truth and right and so forth that it could paradoxically overwhelm her? She could be carried away. And it seems to me all this discourse between her and Jesus about too much light and being blinded, you see, is why she's having trouble with this decision. And it's pointing out the dangers that she's going into as she moves toward transforming her life. In other words, this is a marvelous dream in that it's outlining that for this individual, the transformation process of a spiritual nature is not just a simple one. And that she does not understand yet what this really could mean for her and the implications of it. For example, you know, it could imply that if she got converted or went with the attitude that she still had consciously, she might just be totally so taken that she would lose her moorings, she would lose her groundings. And, you know, there are a number of other possibilities. But I think that this is a good example of how a dream then can actually try to change a person's life direction and change the conscious attitude. Now, finally, Jung talked about other kinds of dreams in which some people's conscious life is just too good. It's too comfortable. It's too well adapted. And that the person has not paid the price of real development, both spiritually and emotionally, for becoming the person they need to be. They've had too many opportunities in life. They've been born in the right family. They've had too much money. They've had too much success. And they're too comfortable. So what will the dreams do then? Jung points out that dreams then will be reductive. And this is, of course, where Freud's marvelous contributions made such a difference. The dreams then may pull you down. They may bring failure into your life. They may bring pain and suffering and sorrow. It reminds me of what someone said about Shakespeare and his plays. They said, why do your plays always end so bad with all the people getting killed and knifed and destroyed? And apparently the answer was, this is the only way people seem to learn. And so too, you know, we have to look at that side of it. Maybe our dreams are unwelcome harbingers of things we do not want to hear. And yet, if we will hear them, they can ground us and round us out and help us become the people we want to be. Think for a moment if you had to live the dreams and lives of, let's take two people, Jesus and Joseph Smith. Now, I don't get the feeling or the impression that they succeeded very well in this world. You know, they didn't have much. When Joseph Smith, for example, died, he was in debt $180,000. He'd lost his family. He'd lost his reputation. He'd been accused of adultery publicly. He was being destroyed at every level. He was being hounded by Missouri for having aided in the killing of the governor of Missouri. Joseph Smith's life was a total failure. Look at the life of Jesus. Where was he? He was a rebel. He was a revolutionary. He had committed treason. He was committed blasphemy by his own people. What were their dreams like? Well, again, apparently that's where their lives had to go to achieve their mission. Well, I will close in by saying that sometimes then I think the reason why we want to dismiss dreams is because perhaps they have unwelcome messages for us, as well as I've said earlier, very important messages. But any way you cut it, I think that dreams are still the most interesting and most exciting pieces of nature that can come to us to help us in this life. Thank you very much.
Well, there's just a few more minutes here, I suppose, if we wanted to take a couple of questions. And go ahead, the gentleman in the blue shirt.
Yeah, messages that are harmful for us.
So the question is, why is our subconscious unconscious the wisest and will be giving us the right answers, I suppose. Would you be kind enough to come back? Try that one.
Well, you have a good point. I, of course, have examined many, many people who have become psychotic and destroyed their whole lives. Van Gogh apparently cut his ear off in apparently a psychotic episode. And I quite agree. We can listen to our dreams, perhaps, and we can go far, far afield. The disease process, which we know occurs to the mind, just like any other part of the body, can certainly take its toll. And I guess that's what we risk. But if I think that we take our dreams and work with them, you see, I certainly don't want to put forth the idea that we sort of just follow a dream. There are lots of people who do that, who think that, oh, we worship at the feet of a dream and we just do whatever it says. And that's not the case. I think there has to be a dialogue, and we have to make that balance. But again, as I said earlier, as you say, dreams may harm us. Yes, they may. If we listen to a dream and we honor what they say, we may be on the road to failure. And then we have to ask the question, is that right or not? Well, as I say, it may be, because sometimes failures may be your most important helps. Well, there are a lot of people who work with dreams. Go to a good Jungian analyst and they'll help you. Well, no, there are many people. No, if you can do this, if you can just, for example, take any dream and work with it, just assume it has meaning and that it's trying to tell you something you don't know about the conscious situation. I submit to you that every person in this room, everybody I know, can begin to get something out of their dreams that will be helpful. Just make that assumption.
It's a final question.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard it said here today that those of us who do not dream are psychotic. And so, as one who is so far down that road, you've made me terrified. How do I now turn off this road and get onto the dreaming one?
Well, the fact is, you do dream, you just don't remember them. We know that everyone who maintains any level of sanity dreams at least 4 or 5 times a night, or there are probably 200 dream images a night. So if I said that was mistaken. You do dream, but you don't remember them. That's what the real issue is. Thank you.
Go. I guess we do have more time, so
yeah, let's.
I think they have the questions are
put. As one who really doesn't remember dreams very well, I awake and think, oh wow, by the time I'm staggered in the bathroom, I completely forget it. How do we go about better remembering?
Well, if you talk with anybody, I don't care who it is, a formal therapist or analyst or anybody else, or even just with friends about dreams, and you at night before you go to bed, if you even just put a pad and pencil or something to try to help you remember your dreams, most people will start remembering dreams. I've had this story hundreds of times. Haven't had a dream that I can remember in 50 years or hardly ever, and they start working on them, and pretty soon dreams come. Yeah, make some conscious effort, and you'll listen, and it'll come. Absolutely.
Rather backhanded reference to Fawn Brody writing a history as our English major. And so I see that you are an English major. What do you think of your analyst credentialed colleague over here, and why should I believe you?
Well,
I really don't mean that in a confrontation.
I don't care whether you believe me or not. I mean, dreams have been very meaningful for my life. I mean, they have literally saved me. But there are some people, I mean, a man came to Jung and said, I want to become a psychiatrist. And so Jung said, fine, let's go over these dreams. And in their very first session, Jung said he discovered a real psychotic center. It scared him to death. He said, what am I going to do with this man? And basically, they both agreed that, you know, maybe this man ought to not look inside. And he left. And Jung was relieved. And, you know, there are certain people. I mean, there was a man sitting on the couch this morning, and he said that he had followed 3 of his dreams, and they had proved totally disastrous, and he thought that dreams were something you should absolutely leave alone. This was before I gave my talk. So I happen to think dreams are really important, in part because I think Marion Woodman is right. I think that dreams tell us where the energy in our culture is going. They tell us where the energy in our families. They give us more information than we have in our conscious lives, and so they can deepen our understanding of any situation. I've received a lot of information from my own dreams about being a parent, about situations with my children. And that's really important to me because there are things that I don't know on a conscious level that I learn from paying heed to my dreams, that I learn about how I'm acting as a parent that I didn't know consciously. And so that allows me to change my consciousness, to change my behavior, to do things differently. But there are all kinds of this. The one woman, Damaris, who, and it's interesting, I really enjoyed his comments about the woman who had the dream of Jesus before she joined the church. She had another dream after that with Moroni, and she said to Moroni, "Should I join the church?" And Moroni said, "That I cannot tell you." What's his response? You have to decide for yourself, is what he said after that. So, I think dreams can provide all kinds of things we just don't know at a conscious level, and that's why dreams are important to me. But if it's not important to you, don't do it.